For the week of October 12th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 253, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at Arnold's Diner, I'm Michael Gills.
Oh, are you in Milwaukee, Wisconsin because you're the winner of Media Insight's Happy Day Trivia Contest? Was the Happy Days in Milwaukee? I guess it was.
Yes, it was. That was TV Media Insight. That was my name there on the list of winners. That's a website and a daily email list that I use a lot. They send overnight information on the TV ratings and news about the industry. It's a really good show, really good website. And we've had Mark Berman on our show as a guest. And they have daily trivia, which I never enter. But every once in a while now, they have a contest. And I thought, I need to get a great Christmas gift for Sperling. And so an exclusive limited edition Happy Days t-shirt, what better gift to get? And so I entered the contest and by God, I won.
And I saw your name spelled out there.
Yeah, and he spelled it right too. I got a couple emails from friends. And one friend sent me an email saying, congratulations.
Yeah, well, I guess because of course, it's usually industry folks that are reading TV Media Insights and Mark Berman's daily newsletter, right?
Right. Well, I'm sure they're casual fans as well. But yeah, it's definitely geared towards the industry. But I'm part of that, right?
Yes. No, as an entertainment journalist, yes, you are a part of the industry.
That's right. So if you read his daily emails, you find out news on television. And if you listen to this week's podcast, Sperling, what will our viewers hear?
Well, they're going to hear about how they can contact us. They can contact us by email, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or they can call us and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, we're on Twitter, at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. Or you could search for us on Facebook, where if you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. And you know you can actually add to the conversation of what we're talking about on today's show. We're going to be talking about Nielsen. You know, the good folks who deliver the television ratings that help determine roughly, you know, $70 billion in ad placement each year in the United States. Turns out there may have been a little glitch in their reporting software, which caused some TV ratings to be off for the past 7 months. Oops. Comedian Adam Sandler, he's back in the news. We talked about him just last week, though this time he's back in the news for a movie which isn't being made, even by Netflix. Composer Stephen Sondheim says he's working on a new musical, and he's either very hungry or is having trouble finding someone to go to dinner with. We'll explain. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We look at the worldwide box office, but we also look at specialized movies that open in North America. So we pull our information from RentTrack. We have links in our show notes. That shows us the number one movie and all the big movies around the world over the past weekend. We also look at Box Office Mojo, which gives us a detailed break on North American movies and a useful guide to what the budget is for each movie, at least what's being reported in the industry, and other information like really small releases that wouldn't make it onto the worldwide box office charts. And this week, we've got links to their website in our show notes every week. And this week, of course, it's back in there, but they were gone. They disappeared for a few days.
Yeah, so we usually use Box Office Mojo, and I guess we did use Box Office Mojo this week. But
well, I filled in some info and pulled it from somewhere else because I didn't have it at the time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because they disappeared. Suddenly the website was down. They're owned by
Amazon,
which owns IMDb and Box Office Mojo. They disappeared. And it seemed like, is it gone into IMDb? But there was nothing there duplicating what Box Office Mojo offered. And then it popped back up, sort of, over the weekend. And then it came back in full force now today. So it is back to where it was. We don't know why. We don't know what's going on. But welcome back, Box Office Mojo.
You know, it's funny. Years ago, this was like the late 90s, early 2000s, Brandon Gray was just this guy who was keeping up all of this data and was getting phone calls from the studios and he'd input the information. But over time, Box Office Mojo became more and more important inside the industry. And it's now the go-to reference for box office news.
Which is why I thought it might have become part of IMDb Pro. That's a section of IMDb you have to pay to get access for. I know casting directors and a lot of people in the industry use that to stay on top of projects and what people are working on and just sort of basic info about movies that are in production, not movies that are about to come out or have already come out. So I thought, well, maybe they're folding that into IMDb Pro to make that more valuable and to be able to charge a few extra bucks. But I don't know what the case is. Maybe someday soon we'll find out.
Maybe.
But we we do know that the number one movie around the world, and by the way, we have about five or six number one movies. I'll explain in a moment. But the number one movie around the world is Dracula Untold. $57 million worldwide. I think it opened up last week in some other territories, so it's now at $86 million and counting.
And that's around the world because, of course, here in the United States and Canada, Gone Girl was the number one movie with $26.8 million.
It just edged out Dracula Untold. That's right. In North America, Gone Girl was number one, and right below that was Dracula Untold with $23 million.
Right.
But Dracula Untold was the number one movie if you were Hispanic or Latino. That movie played very well to that crowd for some reason and did very well in those territories around the world, not just in North America.
To that crowd? Is that like you people? To that crowd? You mean that demographic?
That crowd? That demographic, that crowd.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
People, wasn't meant denigratingly.
No, but it's much funnier if I make it sound as if it were.
Oh, good heavens. Well, thank you.
Okay.
The number one movie of the week, if you're a little kid, however, around the world was probably Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day, which, of course, is based on the classic children's picture book. That grossed how much? That grossed $21 million worldwide. But if you're under 12, that was probably the movie that you saw.
You know, that's one of the first books I can remember reading, that particular book.
As a kid, oh yeah?
Yeah, oh yeah. And I read it to my daughters, and they loved it. And so I brought it in for, you know, when you go into class as a mystery reader. And the kids, you know, because there's pictures in it, they were actually kind of interested.
Oh, very cool.
And they were really interested in, wait, cereal has toys in it? Because, you know, in it, the kid doesn't get any toy in his cereal. But all of his brothers and sisters have a toy in their cereal.
And it happens, but not in every box. You got to make sure you buy the right cereal. I guess that's what happened. Kids today just get healthy cereal.
That's right. There's no toys in Cheerios.
Well, from the people I know who saw it, it wasn't a very good movie, though. It is a great week for Steve Carell. He's in this film, which had a decent opening, and he's also in Foxcatcher, which played at the New York Film Festival and is about to open and be part of the award season. So it's a good week for Steve Carell.
Yes.
However, the number one movie, if you're a black woman, was probably Addicted. That's a film based on the erotic novel by romance writer Zane. I've been reading about her for years. She's a fascinating writer in the romance and erotica genre, very popular. This movie opened only on 846 screens, but it grossed $9,000 per screen. 82% of the audience was female. Zane has a million Facebook fans, and apparently they all went to the movie over the weekend. This did not, this hit reached number 11 on the worldwide charts, but it basically opened in North America, and it grossed, it was on 846 screens. It grossed $7.6 million. It cost about $3 million to make. That's what the reports that we're getting. It comes out from Lionsgate, and they did not have a big TV ad campaign for this movie. They said, we're going to use social media. We're going to reach your audience. We know who they are. We can make this movie for a price. We can release it, and we can be commercially successful without breaking the bank by having a, you know, 3,000 print release and a big TV budget.
Wow. Well, certainly that's true because, you know, very few people knew about this release.
Well, if you're a black woman, you did.
Right. Well, okay, yes.
And it's about a woman who went on who has a string of affairs. It's erotic. It's naughty. It's profitable. The number one movie, if you are in a 14-year-old girl, that was probably One Direction, Where We Are. That's a new concert film from the boys from the boy band in the UK. Simon Cowell helped launch them. It grossed $5 million worldwide in 26 territories. It opened, I think, in North America, though I don't see any information on it. That, of course, is a far cry from the $68 million their last concert film ended up grossing. But we'll have to see where it ends up. But it's not as big an opening as you would have thought. And this is the sort of movie that's very, very front-loaded.
Now, if you were in China, was the number one movie this Breakup Buddies?
No, the number one movie in China was Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh,
that
okay.
That opened in China. It grossed how much did it gross?
$30 million, actually, I see.
$29 million, $29.8 million. So yes, that's almost all in China. There's a little bit. It's still in a few other territories, but it opened there, and that's where the bulk of that money came from. That means Disney gets, what, about $10 million back?
If they can get their hands on it, yes.
That's right. And speaking of getting your hands on money in China, they are tightening up things to try and make China more responsible as far as box office reporting. The government has added in a new initiative. They're going to start posting grosses on social media. They're going to have them as transparent as possible. They're really trying to crack down on theaters that underreport so they can keep more money and not pay to the government and not pay to foreign companies. They're trying to keep a crackdown on companies that are showing movies that aren't authorized. So they're trying to crack down on companies that have two ticketing systems or sell counterfeit tickets, so they never get registered at all. They're doing a lot of steps to try and make China enter the worldwide market of movies in a responsible fashion.
Well, when you have a culture of counterfeiting and you're trying to go legitimate, then it's very difficult to break that kind of mentality of always trying to do something kind of on the sly.
That's right. And if the number one movie of the week, if you were a Mormon, is Meet the Mormons. That was at number 10 in North America with $3.5 million in gross. That's a lot of money for a documentary. And no, it's not Ben Stiller trying to make another spinoff for Meet the Parents. It's an actual documentary about the Mormon faith. Came out of nowhere. It made $3.5 million, presumably already by the converted people who wanted to support the film. They claimed that it was made just to be shown in Salt Lake City, Utah, but they decided it was so good they wanted to put it in theaters. The reviews are very indifferent. They basically say it's an infomercial for the Mormon faith. It's not interesting, but it's rated PG.
What in the world? It's rated PG?
This from the
church that would go into Blockbuster and edit all the movies so they were G-rated, no matter what movie they were.
That's right. So it was rated PG. Nobody's quite sure why. Their explanation when asked was, well, there are scenes of kickboxing.
Okay.
Newsreel clips of the Berlin airlift, as if that's going to get you a PG. Some helicopters landing with food. And talk of teen pregnancy. There's also vague references to domestic abuse. I think it's very brief. But the New York Times had the most pointed explanation. This isn't why it got a PG rating, but this is what they warned people. They said, quote, it has implicit proselytizing.
Yes.
Be careful. They might convert you to their faith.
So shocking. Yes. Okay. So well, that was number 10 on the North American charts. I guess, did it even make the worldwide charts?
No. Well, $3.5 million. Yes, it would have. The Rent Track did not include it, but it would have put it at number 15, just ahead of Lucy, the Scarlett Johansson film. So, you know, you have to keep an eye. There are titles that slip through the cracks in foreign territories, international territories, I should say. That was a thing of Ted Turner, by the way. He didn't like the word foreign. He wanted international. He thought that was friendlier, more positive, and more accurate, because who knows where you are listening to our show. So, yes, that is not on the Rent Track list, but it is on the Box Office Mojo list, along with some small releases that have just started out and looking for award hype, like Whiplash. That's a very good film from Sundance. And St. Vincent, which stars Bill Murray. That also opened very strongly in just a few theaters. That would not ever make a worldwide box office list, but they're off to a good start. So in sum, if you look at the movies around the world, Dracula Untold at $60 million, Gone Girl at $53 million, Annabelle, that's the horror film about the doll spun off from The Conjuring, that grossed another $43 million. Boy, is that profitable. Guardians of the Galaxy is about to pass $700 million. Alexander made $22 million. The Equalizer, the Denzel Washington film, another $21 million, as did The Maze Runner. And Robert Downey Jr. at number 8 with The Judge, which had a relatively soft opening, though frankly, for a Robert Downey Jr. drama, it's one of the highest openings of his career. He just hasn't had a lot of high-grossing dramas in his career.
And the number 9 movie is this movie, Breakup Buddies from China.
That's right. Yeah. Followed by number 10, which is The Box Trolls, the animated film which has opened around the world. It's in 27 territories so far. It's made $72 million, but it has a ways to go to be profitable.
Yeah, I don't know if that movie can be profitable. How much did it cost? Oh, it only cost $60 million to make.
That's right. So it needs to probably make $180 million.
Yeah, probably.
To what we would say is safely a hit. You can make less than that and still break into profit, but you're not a real hit.
Right. I mean, then you're basically, at that point, you're just wiping the sweat off your forehead and thanking whatever higher powers there are that you didn't lose your entire shirt.
That's right. So when you're looking at the number one movie of the week, it depends on who you are, where you live in the world, and of course, what kind of movie you like to see.
Well, I recommend Whiplash. It's a very good movie.
Do you recommend Adam Sandler?
I do recommend Adam Sandler, depending on the movie. Like, for instance, if I were to see him in, off the top of my head, a comedy western, I might not go.
That's right. That's in the news this week, isn't it? A project of his fell through, and the Hollywood Reporter spent a lot of time trying to spin it as fallout from his deal with Netflix.
Yeah, you know, when I first heard this news, I thought to myself, so let me get this straight. A comedy western from Adam Sandler, a comedian, okay, who's, you know, more often than not in comedic roles, right after 8 Million Ways to Die, or A Million Ways to Die in the West, Tanks, and that was that's Seth MacFarlane.
Yeah.
So that was a comedy western this past summer that did not do very well. If you're Warner Brothers, why would you make this movie? Forget about the fact that Adam Sandler is in it. Forget about this Netflix thing that Adam Sandler just signed. Forget all that. Why would you make this particular genre?
Well, the Hollywood Reporter said, quote, he'll both star in and produce the four titles for Netflix, meaning he'll be unavailable for long stretches of time for studio projects. Industry observers question what will happen once Sandler's current Sony commitments, including Pixels and Hotel Transylvania 2, have been completed and he turns his attention to his Netflix projects. What's going to happen to Adam Sandler's career? Is Hollywood going to turn on him? And that was sort of the framing device for this story about the studio passing on Insidious 6. It's a comic western, which has to be the least popular genre imaginable for a Hollywood studio. There's nothing less interesting to them as far as a box office project.
Well, there was Blazing Saddles, and then there, no other comedy western has worked.
Westerns do not travel well. Comedies don't always travel well. And a comic western is just a very small genre that really they don't like. Now, this project has been bouncing around for years. Sony passed on it, then Paramount passed on it. So now Warner Brothers had it, and they hadn't even settled on a budget when they passed on it. And the Hollywood Reporter quotes an insider at Warner Brothers who says the deal with Netflix had nothing to do with their passing on the project.
But as we quote you, we will also frame our entire piece around
the implication
that it was, yes, that it had everything to do with that the Netflix deal had everything to do with this decision.
That wasn't the only big deal that made news, or lack of a deal that made news in Hollywood this week, was it, Sperling?
No, and I'm not so surprised by this next news, actually, that Scarlett Johansson is going to, I guess, now that she is a rising movie star, I always thought she was a rising, I always thought she was a movie star.
I thought she's risen.
Yeah, exactly. She is following up her breakthrough as an action star in Luc Besson's summer hit Lucy by announcing that she will produce and star in an 8-episode miniseries for Sony TV. And it's going to be based on the Edith Wharton novel, The Custom of the Country. The script is going to be written and penned by Christopher Hampton, who is a well-known, playwright and screenwriter. The deal is shocking the industry for numerous reasons, according to you, Michael.
That's right. We're sort of making fun of the Adam Sandler story here. Look at this thing. Scarlett Johansson just made the leap to action star with Lucy. Why would she revert to a period piece where she has to wear a costume and not get to fire a gun?
Well, wait a second. Wasn't she always kind of an action star? What with the Black Widow thing and she's in the Avengers. So,
She hasn't made the Black Widow spinoff yet. Lucy really made her a star on her own as far as action films are concerned. You know, she was part of the ensemble in the Avengers, but a smaller role. And she hadn't proven her bona fides, I think, as an action star to open a film.
Wasn't she also in Captain America? I think she was in Captain America.
Well, yes, she had a playful secondary role, but again, she wasn't the lead.
Okay, fine.
All right. Now she's producing and filming this miniseries. That obviously means she will be unavailable for a long stretch of time for studio projects.
Yeah, okay. I don't buy that because it doesn't take that long to shoot each episode, but go ahead.
8-hour miniseries takes longer than a 2-hour movie.
Well, if you think about it, a 1-hour drama has 8 days to shoot.
A miniseries is not a drama that you make every week. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
An 8-hour miniseries, a period piece, takes a lot longer to film and at least as much, if not more, than your typical Hollywood movie.
Well, okay, let's say it's going to take 3 months to shoot.
Plus, she's producing.
Okay.
Right, so she's going to be involved. So just like Adam Sandler, this is going to take her away from the movies.
Well, what I would say is I wonder about whether the producing role is a hands-on role. Or whether
How dare you suggest she's just taking a title for bragging purposes?
No,
she's
going to
be
actually,
intimately involved in the making of this film.
It's one way. Getting a producing credit is one way to say, no, we're paying the stars and the actors a certain level. And, but we need to pay this, whether it's Adam Sandler or Scarlett Johansson, we need to pay this person extra. We can't do it as an actor because that might tip other scales for other actors. But, hey, you know what we can do? You're also a producer on the film and you get a producing fee.
And just as Adam Sandler upended the apple cart by making a deal with Netflix, she's not even signing on to a project that's with a channel. It's for Sony TV. They haven't even placed the project at HBO or ABC or Netflix or AMC or anybody.
No, Sony TV is a production company.
A little weird that you would announce a miniseries before you even have an outlet for it. I don't recall that happening a lot.
Nah, it's
barely
not
here. You hear A&E's making a miniseries, HBO, Showtime, CBS, Cinemax, whatever. I don't recall the last time I heard a big announcement of a miniseries that wasn't even placed at an outlet yet.
Yeah, no, not a miniseries. A series, on the other hand, you know, you definitely hear about that every now and again.
Really? Such as?
Oh, I knew you were going to say that after I...
I don't recall. People said we're going to make a TV show. We don't know who's going to buy it. It's CBS. It's NBC. It's ABC. It's part of the deal.
Well, yeah, most of the time...
I don't recall ever hearing, we're making a TV show. We don't have anywhere...
Most of the time, Sony TV, as the production company, goes in with the talent to a network, and the network says, all right, we will pilot that particular show, or we will buy, you know, the first 9 episodes of that show, or the first 12 episodes of that show. However, there are times where, you know, a production company will take a flyer and...
I can't name an example. Not one. Oh, I suppose it's happened, but I can't think of one. Who spends millions of dollars on a pilot when they don't even have a potential network for it? People don't commit and say, we're going to do your series, but they at least shoulder the burden and say, all right, we want to see a pilot. We'll work together on this. You know, this is weird. They're saying we're making a mini series, which is going to cost tens of millions of dollars, at least. Mini series are expensive, especially a period. And it's 8 hours long. That's very substantial. And they don't have an outlet. That is very weird. That is weirder than Adam Sandler saying he's making a movie for Netflix.
Well, I guess it also just goes to show you that there are more distribution channels now, and maybe they're leaving themselves open to sell it to Netflix or HBO or AMC, or maybe distributing it through some other means.
Well, that would be a new thing.
Yes.
If a person like Sony TV says, we're going to make this and then see where we can get the most money for it, that's an interesting new, I think, wrinkle. But again,
well, so is Adam Sandler signing a 4-picture deal with Netflix. So
absolutely. So now here we have Scarlett Johansson, and I wonder what's going to happen to her career. She's moving away from movies. She's taking time out. She's doing this crazy miniseries. It's not for a traditional outlet. You know, what's going to happen to her career after she's done filming the sequel to The Avengers, the Black Widow spinoff, the live-action Jungle Book movie directed by Jon Favreau, and presumably Lucy 2?
She's never going to work again, obviously, because she was in this miniseries. So
that's right. Just like Adam Sandler, he's got Pixels. He has Pixels for Sony, is it?
Yeah, Sony, right? Yeah.
He's got Pixels. He's got the animated film Hotel Transylvania 2. He's got a Grown Ups 3 in the offing. Golly, I wonder if those are hits, whether anyone will ever want to work with Adam Sandler again.
They most certainly will, especially if he remains a part of the cultural conversation. Now, what I would say is what doesn't surprise me about this move by Scarlett Johansson is she just had a baby. So maybe one way to kind of
making a miniseries isn't easy.
It's not easy, but at least you're in one place for a very long period of time. And
what are you talking
about? It might be easier.
No, that's crazy. A miniseries shoot is no easier or harder than a movie shoot.
Well, this is where you can say I was being sexist.
Yes, apparently. But no, she's not taking it easy by making an 8-hour miniseries. You take it easy by not taking work. But she can do whatever she wants. She has nannies. She has all the ability in the world to do a great job, I'm sure, doing both. But anyway, it's silly. I was making a joke, the idea that this was some sort of bizarre step on her part. That was the whole point of the piece.
Okay.
To make fun of the idea. Like, if they could pervert the Adam Sandler story, Warner Brothers passing on a project, I was going to pervert her making a miniseries, which is a perfectly normal thing for a big star to do, into some sort of crazy, bizarre thing. It's not. It's normal.
And always loved the book. You know, maybe she always loved Edith Wharton's work. You know, so...
Well, there's nothing to explain.
Exactly. We're vehemently agreeing with one another.
But you were like making excuses like, well, maybe she did this because it's a prestige project. It, you know, gets her away from all these cartoon comic book movies, gets to do something serious, be up for an Emmy, make something substantial and worthwhile. It's a great project. Why not?
And you know what? She's been on Broadway, right? She's done Broadway
work.
She's won a Tony, in fact.
That's right. So now she's going to conquer television.
Yeah.
Who else has conquered Broadway?
Well, I would say Andrew Lloyd Webber, definitely. Let's see, who else? There's any one of a number of, you know, Rodgers and Hart conquered Broadway.
They did.
Rodgers and Hammerstein. You know, Stephen Sondheim conquered Broadway.
Not commercially, but critically.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's been in the news this past week because during an onstage interview at the New Yorker Festival, he revealed that Sondheim, that is, that he's been working on a new musical, a new show.
That's very exciting.
Yeah, he's working with David Ives, and they have just finished the first draft of the show, which is based on two surreal movies by Louis Buñuel. And when I heard that and read that, I thought, well, that should be interesting. Sondheim, who is already kind of surreal at times, with, after all, this is the guy that did Sunday in the Park with George, correct?
A play about a painting.
Correct.
A musical, I should say.
And here he is doing basing a new musical on two surreal movies by Louis Buñuel, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeois, which is about a group of friends who are continually frustrated in their attempts to get together and enjoy a meal. And also, it's based on In the Exterminating Angel, a dinner party. This is about a dinner party.
It's just The Exterminating Angel.
But it is about a dinner party, correct?
Yep.
Where, for some inexplicable reason, none of the guests can leave.
That's right. They're just trapped there somehow. They don't know why or how. It's not like someone is holding a gun to their heads. They just feel incapable of leaving.
Now, all of this says to me, somebody please take Stephen Sondheim out for a meal. Because he's obviously very hungry and very lonely. Nobody will go to dinner with him or something, because it's very interesting that both of these things revolve around, I guess, food.
Well, he loves to play games. He loves puzzles and games pretty famously. I've always wanted to go over to his house and play a game.
Okay.
I don't know. He'd never been invited, but it could happen. I think it's The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, no?
Yes, it is.
Yes, yes.
But, you know, I immediately went to the French pronunciation, which is probably bourgeoisie. So I mispronounced it. That was my way of saying it. But now let me ask you, let's check in with some of these fall shows that are, you know, all the rage here. The hit London play, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Night. In the Nighttime, actually. That is one of my favorite titles. It just opened on Broadway. Now, have you seen it?
Yes, I just saw it. My review is on Huffington Post. I liked it a lot. A very fun presentation of the play. Probably not a great play, but a great production of the play. Just like War Horse. It was made by the same director, and it's visually spectacular. It's about a kid probably with autism that's never identified, but maybe Asperger's syndrome. He's high functioning, and the play gets into his mind, and it's just very cleverly done. It's really good. It deserves to be a hit. It's gotten great reviews, and I think it's going to just build and build and be a strong, long-running word-of-mouth hit.
Well, now, one play, or musical, I should say, that you said might not last past...
I don't believe I said that.
Well, you said it might be hard with Neil Patrick Harris gone, and this is Hedwig. How is that musical doing now that Neil Patrick Harris is no longer starring in it?
Well, I think I said, just like the original, I mean, John Cameron Mitchell famously created that role, and then other people stepped in and kept that show going for quite a while, like the great Michael Cerveris and even Ali Sheedy. So okay. There was no reason why that couldn't continue with this production on Broadway. But the stakes are higher, no question about that. Andrew Reynolds stepped in. He's not a big name, but he's a talented Broadway actor. He was in The Book of Mormon, of course, and he ultimately did a good job. He just finished this week. The show grossed $660,000 in his final week, and that's a holiday weekend. So all the grosses are up this week, and he sold 93% of all the tickets available that week. And given that the show probably has a very low operating cost, it's a small cast, no orchestra. Therefore, I think that was well into profitability. And now Michael C. Hall of Dexter and 6 Feet Under is taking it over, and he's going to be a big draw. So I think we've gotten past the hump of having to follow Neil Patrick Harris. Now we've got a big name in it. No apologies to Andrew Reynolds, but Michael C. Hall's a big name and a big draw. They're going to probably bring the critics back for reviews. I think this show's going to have a really good long run. We'll have to see what happens. That's certainly the case with Once. That show, which I loved, is announced its closing in January. That will be after 1,100 performances. I loved it, and that makes it one of the longest-running shows in Broadway history. We'll have to see if there's as much luck for On the Town and Sting's The Last Ship. Those are two new musicals. They're both in previews. Neither one of them is doing great. They both need really good reviews in order to take off.
Well, now with Once, I mean, the grosses of that musical have been falling slowly for some time.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
Oh, you didn't pick up on it. Falling slowly? Come on.
Oh, I did miss that. Well done. Well done.
Now, what is the biggest hit of the fall? Like, if you had to pick one.
It's The Lion King.
No. The biggest hit of the fall is what I'm asking.
It's The Lion King.
Not the biggest hit of a fall from like 20 years ago. I'm asking the biggest hit of this fall.
And still, it's The Lion King. It grossed $2 million last weekend. That's all. It's the $2 million club, the only show to gross that much. It was one of 6 shows that were completely sold out.
Ah, okay. Are there sellouts? Are all these shows that are selling out, these six shows? Are they long-running hits like, I don't know, Wicked or The Book of Mormon?
Well, The Book of Mormon sold out, but Wicked actually did not. It just undersold out. It was 96%, okay. Still a massive hit. But three of the shows on that sellout list are pretty new, and two of them set records. Aladdin, the Disney musical, set a new house record with 1.6 million. And Beautiful set a new house record with 1.4 million. And the Tony winner for Best Musical, the most recent Tony winner, A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, that sold out too. So everybody loves the holiday weekend because people flocked to the theater. And remember, if you're selling out, the only way to set a new record is to raise prices.
That's true. That is, you're absolutely right, because there's only so many seats in a theater.
You can't sit on people's laps. It doesn't work.
Although you could, standing room. Maybe. But I guess if you're selling out, you're also selling out standing room.
They often are. It's true. If you look at Book of Mormon, that sells out like 116% of its gross and 104% of available tickets, to which you say, huh? But yes, Broadway does not have standing room the way London theaters often do, but there is sometimes standing room available, and that does account for some of that bump.
Okay, so those are musicals. Are there any plays or dramas that we should talk about?
Well, there's one that sold out. It's only a play.
Yeah, okay. But what's it called?
It's only a play.
Okay. What is the title of the show? You already told us it's only a play.
Exactly.
Well, okay, we know it's only a play.
You got it.
Wait, the name of the play is You Got It?
No, it's only a play.
Wait a second. Is it on Broadway?
Yes.
Is it the show starring Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick?
Yes.
Is it a comedy?
Yes.
Did it gross $1.1 million last week?
Yes.
Okay, what's the name of the play then? And don't tell me it's only a play, because we know it's only a play.
If you know the name of the play, why are you asking me?
I give up. Let's move on to baseball.
You know, it's a funny thing about baseball. A lot of the players have really funny names.
Okay, let's stop. Let's move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop.
I enjoyed myself.
Now, you have to explain that the name of the play is actually, it's only a play.
God forbid they don't figure that out by now.
Okay, well, I guess then it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. Pop star Katy Perry will be headlining the Super Bowl halftime show. The musical guest for next year's big game took a little longer than usual to announce because the folks in charge of the Super Bowl suddenly thought, why should we pay someone to get all this valuable exposure? They should pay us. But they reportedly asked Katy Perry and Coldplay and Rihanna if they'd pony up some money, and as we could have told them, they got a definitive no. So now Perry is on board. Was she paid? Did they cover all her expenses for the performance, which may be a little costlier and trickier than usual given the relatively short window she has in which to prepare? And is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. It turns out the acts are never actually paid. They just perform for free, but the people pay their expenses to mount it and rehearse it and put it on, which, of course, gets well into seven figures. You know, it's not like you just can show up and do it. You got to have an elaborate, specific show geared towards TV. You bring in special guests. You know, it's complicated. But my God, this is just so typical of the world. It's like nobody wants employees. Nobody wants to pay anyone for anything. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, and I get that, you know what, you know, Katy Perry or Coldplay or Rihanna would, you know, benefit anybody that's performing at the halftime show.
But the Super Bowl benefits. You know what got the highest ratings of the Super Bowl? The halftime show. You can't guarantee an enjoyable, entertaining game, but you can guarantee a happy and entertaining halftime show because you get the biggest acts in the world. You're saying, yeah, show up for our halftime show. We're going to have 100 million people show up and we want them to watch you, but you're lucky to have it. So, you know, really, you should pay us. It's unbelievable.
Well, you know what the players should do, or what they should tell the players is, look, you know, we're going to have 100 million people watch this game. You should pay us for the privilege of playing in the game.
Absolutely.
Actor Stephen Collins, star of the long-running drama Seventh Heaven, the critically acclaimed Tattingers, and numerous other shows.
Show.
Yeah, he's kind of a working journeyman actor. He's been in a lot. He has reportedly been accused of child molestation. He's been accused by actor Stephen Collins. Wait, what? Stephen Collins has been accused by actor Stephen... Oh,
keep
okay.
going, keep going.
Well, TMZ, which is apparently fast becoming the National Enquirer of our time, brought out what was claimed to be a secret audio recording of Collins, which was made by his wife during a therapy session in 2012. She is now divorcing him, causing the recording to surface somehow. The fallout was quick, Collins resigned from the board of SAG-AFTRA and was dropped by his talent agency. He was also cut from a small part in Seth MacFarlane's sequel to the hit film Ted, a blink-and-you-miss-it turn on Scandal. He was dropped from that, and more than likely a whole bunch of other work. Then the family-oriented cable channel Up announced it was pulling reruns of the wholesome Seventh Heaven from its schedule. Collins reportedly discussed exposing himself to three girls under the age of 14 and having one of them touch him inappropriately. A formal complaint has been filed, and a division of the NYPD is investigating. Big deal or big whoop?
Ugh, it's a big, big deal and an ugly, we just got rid of the last story, it seems like, for a while, with accusations of sexual impropriety and rape, with big Hollywood directors and producers and executives. Now we've got this ugly story. It's ugly in every possible way. But one thing made me laugh.
In this story? I hope you're moving on to the next story when you're talking.
No, in this story, it's like, we were getting emails from, the Hollywood Reporter and other people, hourly updates, the scandal breaks. His agent has dropped him. Da da da. The cable channel refuses to show Seventh Heaven. I'm like, for the love of God! I thought next was going to be IMDb says we're erasing all his credits from our database. I mean, are you trying to erase him from history? Why would you pull reruns of Seventh Heaven? No child watching that show has heard the news stories or cares. They're just watching a wholesome family. It was just bizarre. I thought, just weird. Why would that happen? Just to me, it was just a crazy, Soviet style attempt to pretend he never existed. And it just was creepy and funny and odd. But the whole story is terrible. His wife had this happen in 2012, but she releases it now, really? Because she was concerned about something. Surely she should have gone to the authorities in 2012. A pox on all of them. And of course, God help any poor child that he did molest and damaged. It's just an ugly, terrible story.
In an uncomfortable revelation that has the software company Adobe dancing as fast as it can, it turns out their ebook digital platform called Adobe Digital Edition collects information on readers without their knowledge and sends it back to the company in unencrypted form.
Whoops.
Adobe insists this is nothing new, but it's news to consumers and news especially to the libraries and other institutions that widely use it. Adobe confirms the data gathered includes what you're reading, how much you've read, what device you're reading it on, and where you're reading. Other reports insist the spyware also looks at your entire library and a whole bunch of other info. To make matters worse, Adobe also confirms the information is transmitted to them in an unencrypted manner, so others can potentially have illegal access to all this data as well. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big deal because this is what libraries use to loan out ebooks to a lot of people. It's one of their main platforms that they use. It's this Adobe software. And they're very big on privacy. They've been fighting for laws to make sure the courts can't just willy-nilly demand to see their records on who reads what. And now they've got this big potential breach of privacy. It's very concerning. But the nice thing is, they haven't quite taken off on e-reading via libraries. So hopefully this will help them focus, put in some good privacy standards and safeguards, and make sure that any outside vendors they use meets their expectations of privacy for their readers.
Well, now, there's this new book that everybody's talking about, this Lena Dunham book. I've seen it reviewed in the LA Times, the New York Times, and in various outlets. What's going on with this book?
Well, I hope. I guess we could ask Adobe. They know who's read it, how much of it they've read, where they were reading it.
Right.
But I think when it came out, Random House paid a $3.5 million advance. And I think I said at the time that that was pretty crazy high. I know everybody got into a feeding frenzy. It's a cool, hip artist. The TV show Girls, they probably all watch it. They love it. But to me, it seemed like they were overpaying. The idea that this book was going to become a multi-million copy bestseller was really, you just can't expect something like Fancy Pants by Tina Fey. That's a very rare beast. And Lena Dunham does not have that big an audience. Girls doesn't reach that many people. Everybody who watches it is cool. They all write articles about it. And so what happened? The book came out, and from what we know, it sold about 38,000 print copies during its first week. That's not a lot. And that doesn't include Amazon sales. It doesn't include ebook sales, though I assume the publisher knows the final figures and could share them with us if they wanted to. And of course, the figures come from BookScan, which is a division of Nielsen. So God knows.
So it wasn't 38,000 copies. It was 3,800 copies.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was 38,000 copies. So probably a little bit more than that. It could be as much as 50,000, 55,000. It's a fine start for a collection of essays. It's what I would expect. a collection of essays to sell from a really big name. Believe me, collections of essays don't sell a lot of copies. So this is actually a very good number. It's just not a good number when you paid $3.5 million to get it.
Well, put it in perspective for us. We know what the first week sales were for the latest James Patterson book?
Well, that would be into the, you know, this day and age. Of course, we don't know figures. We don't know what books sell because Amazon sells like 60% of all ebooks and they don't release figures. So the publisher could tell us, but they rarely release those numbers on time. So we really don't know. But I would imagine James Patterson, you know, a new book, he has 12 a year. He's going to sell at least six figures of that book. But that's just the first week.
You know, I write a book every month as well.
Well, if you have collaborators helping you, maybe you could.
Harry Potter is coming to China. The government there has just approved a $3 billion plus theme park to be built in the suburbs of Beijing. The Universal theme park in Japan has been a resounding success, and now they're going to do it again in China. Ultimately, sitting on 1,000 acres, this will be the biggest theme park Universal has ever built.
It's a big country.
Yeah, well, I guess you got a lot of space. The company is joining Disney and DreamWorks Animation, who are already playing the theme park game in China. Plus, Wanda, the Chinese company that owns the AMC theater chain here in North America, they have plans to build hundreds of children's theme parks around the country, presumably more modest, like Six Flags-style sites. Is this all a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. Theme parks continue to grow. It's a big profit center for corporations, and they can be dependable and steady income as long as you maintain them and keep them spruced up. But I love it. Opening a theme park in Beijing, people immediately made jokes like they can sell Harry Potter-themed oxygen tanks because there's a lot of pollution in Beijing, and that is an issue. But as one person said, hey, you know, they opened a theme park in L.A. and they had smog. So, you know, this isn't a new problem for anyone, but it is especially bad in Beijing right now. So, you know, that may become an issue.
10 former college football players have filed a class action lawsuit in Tennessee federal courts. They want the major networks to stop making TV deals for football, American football, since athletes may have the right to profit from those deals. And they want the networks to hand over all their profits, or at least some of them. This is one obvious fallout from a court ruling that involved video games in which college athletes and their schools were clearly identifiable. The courts ruled that student athletes can and should participate in the profits from those deals in one way or another, potentially bringing an end to the charade of the student athlete playing solely for school spirit and the love of the game. or a scholarship, when others are reaping billions of dollars. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop.
Ah, okay.
Because it probably won't go anywhere. We'll have to see if they have standing. We'll have to see where it goes. Obviously, the whole college football system is in turmoil. But these guys, they should pay attention to Katy Perry. They're lucky they didn't have to pay to play college football.
That's right. Over the Top is the new black. Over the Top, and I say that with air quotes, or OTT, refers to making your cable channel or just your programming available to people online without the bother of launching an actual channel and getting it carried by cable and satellite providers in a given territory. HBO does it the old-fashioned way in the U.S. and over-the-top in countries where it doesn't have a pay channel presence. Netflix is pure over-the-top. They don't have a channel at all. ESPN is pure cable channel. Now they're stars. The pay channel is looking to expand its brand around the world, so they're launching a streaming service in the Middle East, Africa, Asian, and Latin America. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's sort of in the middle. I mean, it's a big deal as far as a trend. It's not a big deal for Stars itself. Are there that many people around the world dying to get access to Black Sails, or what's it called? The pirate show?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't even know what it's called.
I have no idea.
What is the big star show right now? You know, this is one of the reasons why people think they hate cable, but they don't necessarily, because there are a lot of channels. Do they really think we're going to pay $3 or $5 or $10 a month for all these different channels? Do you have enough stuff that I want to? Do Stars offer enough programming that I want to pay $5 or $8 a month? You know, suddenly you've got 100 channels on your list. That gets to be pretty pricey.
But it's they have nice. A lot of movies. They do license a lot of movies. In fact, when I saw that Africa was on this list, I wonder if they're going to show Outbreak in Africa.
Well, why not? It's a film. And it's markets where it's easier to do this than to get onto a cable channel service. So it makes sense. It's the wave of the future. But I think you might want to see some bundling and maybe people help it make it, you know, finding these channels, knowing these over-the-top services are available, paying a monthly fee. It gets pretty complicated.
Michael, here's the deal. My Comic-Con is bigger than your Comic-Con.
No, it's not.
Well, comic book fans, they like to debate esoterica, like who would win in a battle, Batman or Superman? Duh, Superman, everybody knows that.
Not if Batman could afford to buy a lot of kryptonite. Ooh, booyah!
Oh, that's true. Or, who is hotter, Wonder Woman or Lara Croft? Oh, that one's hard. Well, here's one for you. Which is bigger, the original cooler San Diego Comic-Con or the New York Comic-Con? This year, with record attendance, it looks like New York Comic-Con, with some 151,000 people flooding the convention center, the Jacob Javits Convention Center, right? It's the Big Apple, baby. Sales of comic books and graphic novels are up this year, and more comic book stores are opening as the comic industry slowly adapts to the new digital world. Luckily, fans still like to collect the books themselves. It's just not as fun to say you've got an original number one PDF of the Uncanny X-Men series, is it? Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's a big deal. I mean, it has not passed the San Diego Comic-Con in terms of importance and in who and the draws and who shows up there to promote their stuff. San Diego is still where the action is. But hey, more people are there. That's a big, big shift. And I think we're going to see more and more big stuff happen at the New York Comic-Con in years to come. It just proves how important it is, the social part of it. It's not just, you know, it's really people gathering together, wearing the costumes, seeing each other, enjoying the spectacle of the event. It's like the Burning Man for comic book buffs. And you can't just have it in one place because it's a big country. So I think it's really interesting. We'll have to see if New York can become as cool as San Diego in the years to come.
Well, what about the Comic-Con that's held in Ventura at the Ventura County Fairgrounds?
Bless their hearts.
AMC's The Walking Dead hasn't stopped growing. The acclaimed, wildly popular, and Emmy-ignored drama reached 17.3 million viewers on its season premiere, and barely an old fogey among them. That's probably because the old fogies were all eaten by the zombies, you see. Advertisers really care about the 18 to 49-year-olds when it comes to prime time, foolish as that might be. And in that demo, they reached a massive 11 million viewers.
Wow.
As Variety points out, once you add in live plus seven figures for the week, the audience will hit about 22 million viewers. Then Hollywood Reporter pointed out that that ain't the half of it. Once you add in encores, you know, what used to be called reruns, and other platforms, last season alone, the show averaged about 28 million viewers per episode. Big deal or big what, Michael?
I think it's a very big, I think it's a very big deal. It's a very big deal. 28 million people. I have watched this show and looked at the numbers obsessively. I don't recall ever hearing about this idea that the ultimate number was about 28 million people. Do you?
No, never.
Right. Like, what the heck? Why are they hiding the facts about how many people are
actually
watching?
Well, because it may not
TV?
Be a fact. This is the Hollywood Reporter kind of surmising.
Well, but I believe them with reruns and other platforms and encores. That's not included in the live plus seven figures. And I've heard 22 million. So they're saying another 6 million people watch the encores and watch it on other platforms, like wherever it's available online. I can find that believable. But heck, you know, are these all these people being missed by Nielsen? Are all these people being missed when the studios report how big their shows are? Why are they trying to put their light under a bushel? I don't get it. Look at American Horror Story, Freak Show. That new season opened up on FX. It debuted to 13 million people, including DVR and encores. But is that everybody? I don't know. Maybe it'll be even bigger in a week or two once they got all the facts in. It's a record for that channel for any show at any time, not just that series. So these shows are what people are watching TV, and that message is not getting out. I don't know why they don't lay down the law and start to do a better job of promoting exactly how many millions of people are watching television.
Maybe they're afraid that they actually don't know because Nielsen isn't telling them. We'll get to that in just a moment. The AMC channel is giving up on reality TV. We just talked about The Walking Dead, which is, yeah. The cabler, which, by the way, we gave up on reality TV years ago, so they're actually behind the curve on that one. The cabler, which can boast of The Walking Dead, the final few episodes of Mad Men, and, well, little else, has decided to focus on scripted TV. They're dumping all their failing shows like Game of Arms, Small Town Security, and Freak Show. The lone exception? The Talking Dead, the Chris Hardwick companion piece to The Walking Dead that gets 5 or 6 million viewers just on momentum alone. I think it's people not changing the channel or turning off the TV. The channel's biggest success has been with scripted shows, and it has two spinoffs coming. the Breaking Bad spinoff Better Call Saul, and the Walking Dead spinoff about two zombies who try to be roommates. One is really messy, and the other one is really neat and tidy, and they drive each other nuts. Just kidding. Is this a big deal or a big what, Michael?
It's like the comedy episode.
And you know what? My delivery has been phenomenal.
It's been perfect. This is a big deal because I think it's dumb.
Yeah.
I think you know, reality is a term we use for everything from talent competitions to documentary style shows to game shows to everything that's not scripted. And of course, there are scripts for a lot of reality shows, but you know what we mean. It's not fictional drama or comedy or whatever. It's a reality-based show, whatever the format might be. And there's a lot of different things out there. Why would you just say, well, we don't ever want to have that? That's dumb. You're a 24-hour channel with a lot of space to fill, very few original shows. You didn't do a good job, obviously. Nobody was running to see Small Town Security. But the idea that that genre is dead to you, I think that's stupid.
Well, I guess that would make it a big deal, but that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Here's how they affect you this week. Nielsen got all the ratings wrong, and maybe some of the television shows you love, like Smash, got canceled because...
Not Smash, but especially shows on ABC got overreported. Nielsen says there was a glitch in their software.
Now, do we need to explain who or what Nielsen is?
Dear God, no, do we? Nielsen is the company that provides ratings information to the broadcast networks and the advertisers. They're
the cable networks.
Arbitrator that says this is what this show earned. This is how many people watch this show, et cetera, breaking it down into a million bits and pieces. That is the figure that is used by cable and network and other people to say how much an ad on that show will cost. And if it doesn't meet a certain, you know, mark, like we say, we're going to guarantee you 4 million people. If you get them only 3 million people, you have to do a make good, which means give them another ad or give them some money back. So this is the data that everyone uses in the TV industry. It's essential to advertisers and network executives and the companies making the shows who are independent and the cable channels. This is what everybody uses, and they've been wrong for the past 7 months.
Well, it's only 7 months. How important could that possibly be? There's only $70 billion in ad revenue and ad spending that kind of counts on those numbers being correct. Only $70 billion. To put that in perspective, the North American box office is $10.5 billion. So, you know, how important are Nielsen ratings really?
Right. To put it into perspective, Nielsen says it's only been 7 months and the vast majority of shows are only off in their ratings by like 0.02 or 0.2%. It's a very small error, and they say it's well within statistical error, so it shouldn't be that big a deal. They did acknowledge that a few shows did get overreported, meaning they said they had more viewers than they thought. And for some reason, this was especially prevalent for ABC. So some of their new shows that got off to a very good start, like Blackish, the sitcom, and Once Upon a Time, the new season with Frozen characters added to it, those numbers may be higher than they actually were.
So is it like, you know, those rear view mirrors where objects in the mirror can appear closer than they actually are? Here, in this case, ratings might appear larger than they actually were.
That's right, exactly, especially for their shows. I don't know if it affected all day parts. So, in fact, I had a story in Big Deal, Big Whoop about ABC News. They beat NBC News in the ratings last week. It was big news. First, Diane Sawyer won the May sweeps in a certain genre, and now David Muir, who's taken over for her, he beat Brian Williams and CBS among all viewers, as well as viewers in 18 to 49 and 25 to 54. That's the first time that had happened in 6 years. But, of course, it may not have actually happened. Because we don't know, the Nielsen ratings are inaccurate. And that matters, not just to advertisers, but when you get a lot of news stories saying, hey, ABC News is the hot new show, that might get someone to turn in.
Yeah, I don't see people tuning in. I see them going to, like, you know, CNN.com or you know, NewYorkTimes.com.
Well, I'm just saying, if you see a lot of stories saying this show is the high ratings, it might make you, I said my TVers, hey, see what the show looks like, see how they're doing. I did that as an industry person, but casual people do that too. You see what the number one movie of the country is, that might make you go next week. That happens a lot.
Well, because, are they going to go backwards and fix these ratings?
Well, that's the weird thing. The ratings mistake began in March, and Nielsen says, well, we'll go back to August and make sure we cover all the new fall shows, but we're not going to go all the way back to March. I mean, that's bizarre to me. Won't those other people demand it? They pay them, Nielsen, a lot of money for these figures. Shouldn't they demand that they go back to March and give us the accurate data?
Well, I think that in certain cases, at least just looking at the talent and creative side, not even the advertising side, you have certain bonuses that are kind of they rely on the ratings hitting certain numbers. So if the numbers were wrong, then agents and lawyers or for actors and directors and producers are going to be requesting to see whether those ratings were correct or not.
Well, this is a big deal because this really is the currency of the realm, the coin of the realm, I should say. That's the phrase. And I think people have been uneasy about Nielsen for a while. They've always known Nielsen misses people who are watching shows in bars or college dorm rooms or, you know, group settings. They know that Nielsen is missing people who are watching on other platforms. Nobody's sure how to fix it, but they know it's not really accurate right now. Now we know even the people they're actually counting, they're not getting right. And Nielsen says they discovered the mistake, and others say, no, you didn't. We discovered the mistake because they saw weird numbers for Dancing with the Stars and said, those numbers make no sense. And they went back to Nielsen and complained and said, are you sure about those? And that was what sort of opened the door and made them realize that they'd had this glitch. So there's a lot of bad will. Maybe people don't want to have it go back that far. They don't want to reopen that can of worms. Maybe they're all saying, look, let's just accept that those numbers are what they were reported, and we'll try to get it right from now on. But, you know, I think it's a mess. I think ratings in general are a mess. We don't ever hear how many people actually watch these shows, like The Walking Dead, 28 million people. That's a very different number from 17 million people. So, you know, I don't think they're doing a good job with the numbers that they have. And I don't think they're doing a good job of capturing all the people and how they watch TV today. It's a big problem. Nielsen knows it. It's a headache. They'd love to fix it if there was an easy way to do it, but there isn't. And it's just going to get worse.
Well, you know, I realize now that none of my viewing ever gets counted since I'm always watching in a bar or in a dorm room. Okay, well, I guess maybe that does kind of wrap up Inside Baseball for this week, doesn't it?
That's right. And it's time for the In Memoriam section.
Right. Now, we have a number of obituaries. Do we want to do maybe just one of these since we almost have a one-hour show?
Let's just mention them very quickly because we do need to mention all three.
Okay, well, Marion Seldes. She was a legend of the theater. She was known especially for her lifelong link to the plays of Edward Albee.
See, it's like when you think of theater, you picture Marion Seldes. I just killed myself that I never got to see her in Three Tall Women, the legendary production of Edward Albee's play. And she entered the Guinness Book of World Records. She was in Death Trap on Broadway for 5 years. 1,793 performances, never missed a single one. She is just a Broadway legend.
Now, was Nielsen telling you that? Because if so, that number might be off.
That's
just saying.
Right.
Now, Jeffrey Holder also passed away. He's the 7-Up guy, but he's also...
No caffeine. Never had it. Never will.
Yes. And, you know, that's here in the U.S. You might know that. But he was a vivid character in the James Bond film Live and Let Die. That's probably how international listeners know him.
That's right. And that's all I knew about him. I didn't even realize he had been a Broadway director. He had a great career. We've got a link to his obituary. He directed and created the costumes for the original production of The Wiz on Broadway. He was a part of a dance troupe and a choreographer. He took them to New York from Trinidad and became a principal dancer for the Metropolitan Opera Ballet. He published a book on Caribbean folklore and a cookbook. I mean, and on top of all of that, he was an accomplished sculptor, photographer, and especially a painter. The first big break he got was getting a Guggenheim grant for his painting, which he did all his life and had displayed in museums all over the world. So a fascinating guy, much more than just the 7-Up fella.
And yet he'll be remembered as no caffeine. Never had it, never will.
Exactly.
That's almost poetic the way it rolls off the tongue. Speaking of poets, Carolyn Kaiser. She was a Pulitzer Prize winning poet. She died at the age of 89 of dementia-related illness. Don't necessarily know what that means. She had a poem published in The New Yorker when she was 17 years old, much like myself.
Yes, she's one of my favorite poets. She's a terrific poet, known for Pro Femina, one of her big works. It's a 5-part cycle that she published over decades, but just a terrific talent, very accessible, as well as ambitious and smart and funny and political. But I love this one little poem. There's a poem that she talks about her father and his inability to forge a connection with her. And I just like, imagine your child writes this about you, Sperling. This poem begins, "The room is sparsely furnished, a chair, a table, and a father."
Okay. Father just, as object.
Yeah, and sparsely.
Yes.
It just feels, oh, thanks, kids. Oh, well. But she is one of my favorite poets. You can Google her and find poetry all over the web. And, of course, go buy one of her collections, but a terrific talent.
Well, that wraps up the show for this week. And in almost record time, by the way, I might add, let me just quickly tell our listeners that you can subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher or wherever they give podcasts away for free. You can usually find our podcast there, Showbiz Sandbox. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to the show, which we do appreciate it when you subscribe. iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher. You'll also find on our website, showbizsandbox.com, ways to email us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook, where you can, I think it's facebook.com/showbizsandbox is the way to look us up. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their own website, who is MGMT.com. Now, Michael, you have a website, and every week it's something new and interesting. What is it this week?
You can find me online at thecuriousincidentofthewriterinthenighttime.com.
Or if you can't find Michael's work, detailing the trials and tribulations of the entertainment industry there, try the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com or head on over to bookfilter.com. Some of my writing can be found at celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.